Welcome to Occult of Personality at occultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thank you for listening. This is a Cult of Personality podcast, episode number 124, featuring an interview with Timothy Hogan. You can find us online at occultofpersonality.net, which features a large assortment of recorded interviews for your listening pleasure. Support for a Cult of Personality podcast comes from the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section, as well as generous listeners from all over the world. While integral to our success, listener support became even more crucial when the Occult of Personality website was attacked on the evening of Wednesday, September 26th, in a massive denial-of-service attack that brought down the website temporarily. Since it wasn't the first large-scale attack, the web hosting company suspended the domain and then refused to bring the website back up, claiming it was affecting their entire network. This forced me to take drastic measures and find more secure web hosting. The costs involved in hardening the site against similar attacks are significant, but loyal listeners stepped up and made donations to get the website back up in less than a week. I was a bit overwhelmed by the outpouring of generous support, both financially and otherwise, during this minor ordeal. Thank you all for chipping in to allow for the continuation of free recorded interviews on subjects that are important to all of us. I'll never forget your generosity of money and spirit, and this episode is dedicated to all of you who helped. Now, this list is a bit long, but I felt it was important to acknowledge the assistance. So thanks again to Steve M., Steve S., Lance, Skip, Tau DeCethius, Tau Thomas, Tau Allen, Father Anthony, Father Donald, Michael S., Scott R., Rich S., Diana K., David M., Sasha C., Kylie, Doug S., Drew H., Philip L., Diane W., Aaron F., Chris L., Daniel J., Stephen I., Paolo Samut, Steve 777, Sam, Nanette, Jen, Folger Esoterica, Scarlet Imprint, Jill S., Bill W., Mitch S., Dawn N., Christian M., Michael W., Nick P., Gary M., Alarf, Aaron, Julian Vane, Nathan L., Peter C., Chad B., M. R., Paul Weston, Mark K., Frank H., Jason D., Claire H., D. C., Peregrine, LeFol, Stephen, Marcus M., Bill B., Brittany A., Sandra, Michael S., Travis Apollonius, Gordon, Craig W., David B., Ariok, Joseph Thebus, and JGB at the Hermetic Library at hermetic.com. There were also several anonymous donations, and if I forgot anyone, I apologize for the oversight. It certainly wasn't intentional. Now, in podcast episode number 124, an interview with author and lecturer Timothy Hogan, who was our guest previously in podcast episode number 91. Hogan is a past master of East Denver Lodge number 160, Ancient Free and Accepted Masons. He's also a Knight Templar, a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason, a Knight Commander of the Court of Honor, a past Sovereign Master of AMD Council 425, a member of the Royal Order of Scotland, a member of SRICF, an SII in a Martinist lineage, and a district lecturer for the Grand Lodge of Colorado. He is also a member and leader of several additional chivalric and esoteric orders, including Circes. Hogan has presented numerous lectures around the world on the subject of Freemasonry and esotericism. His experience and eloquence have distinguished him among Masonic and esoteric scholars, and his passion and wisdom are evident in his writing, which wonderfully conveys the symbolic richness and majesty of the Western esoteric tradition. In this interview, we focus primarily on his most recent book, Entering the Chain of Union, and the travels he undertook for his research. Timothy Hogan, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's really great to speak with you once again.
Thank you so much. I always love appearing on your show.
It's really good to speak with you, and I know I got a lot of feedback on our last interview, which we talked about alchemical keys to Masonic ritual, as in the 32 Secret Paths of Solomon, the Kabbalah and Freemasonry, the two of the books you had published previously. And I'm hoping we can talk about some of the things you've been up to more recently today, because I know you've been extremely busy doing a variety of really interesting things. So without further ado, why don't we talk a little bit about some of your travels?
Yeah. Well, I have the last year in particular been traveling quite a bit, particularly meeting with the leaders of different esoteric traditions around the world, and also touring some of the ancient monuments and things of that nature. It's been kind of a threefold process. On the one hand, there's been some diplomatic work that's been being done, meeting with, you know, various religious leaders and that type of thing. On the next part of it has been research for, primarily for Circes International, and some of the work that it's involved in with studying spiritual traditions and doing kind of a compare and contrast and making that information available to members. And then kind of the third aspect of it, I guess, has been just collecting research for a new book that's coming out here called Entering the Chain of Union, which is an exploration of the esoteric tradition in general and kind of the similarities and the doctrines and the myths that these traditions all pass on that are similar. So it's been busy. I think in the last year in particular, I've been in countries as far away as Nigeria, Lebanon, Turkey, Egypt. We did some initiation work in Egypt in the Great Pyramid, so it's been very exciting.
Boy, I'll say that sounds fascinating. I'd like to ask you, because I think the aim of your book in comparing and finding similarities in various esoteric traditions is really fascinating. Many writers in the past have endeavored to do something similar. You mentioned Albert Pike. One thinks of Madame Blavatsky as well, along similar lines. It seems like you were actually taking the journey, and your qualifications and your contacts put you in a unique position to do this work. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, I think people like Blavatsky and Pike and others did a good job in passing down an oral tradition in which they had been aware of the fact that, you know, there are connections between the Western systems and other Eastern and Middle Eastern traditions as well. But, of course, travel was harder back in those days. And even though Madame Blavatsky did do quite a bit of traveling, and there's some evidence that she may have met with some, you know, some different traditions, particularly in the Middle East. You know, the subject always remained kind of vague. They would say, well, you know, like Pike would say, you know, tradition has it that the Crusaders, like the Templars, had been in contact with the Druze, for example, or the Sufi, and that we inherited, you know, Freemasonry inherited things from those contacts during the Middle Ages. But he doesn't really say what those things are or, you know, how there could be a connection there. And so really what I'm hoping to do in my book is really get into what some of these doctrines are, some of the rituals, some of the traditions, you know, that are identical that have just never been written about before. And part of that is, you know, Western initiates in particular, they kind of get caught up in their tradition, and they either get too caught up in the idea that it's all just made up in metaphor, or they just never had the opportunity to go visit groups. But I can say with a great deal of certainty that there have been associations throughout the history, like throughout the centuries, between, you know, high initiates in the Western world and initiates in other traditions. For example, one of the former sovereign grand masters of the Order Sovereign du Temple Initiatique, the Knight Templar lineage I represent, Raymond Bernard, who was also the former Grand Master of Rosicrucians in France and had been involved in a number of things. He used to meet pretty regularly back in the 80s with Kamal Jumblatt, who was the Grand Master of the Druze prior to his assassination. And you know, they have a mystical and a Gnostic doctrine and an initiatic tradition, you know, which parallels things in great detail that we'd recognize in the Western traditions. To give just one example, their tradition states that they started out in ancient times, some say back in Egypt, and that they believe there are certain souls that came to this planet in order to help wake people up and to attain a state of gnosis. And the names of these souls and their secret doctrines regarding the spiritual arts and sciences were put inside two hollow pillars, one to withstand fire and one to withstand water. And they adopted the symbol of the blazing five-pointed star as a symbol for gnosis from that time forward. This is their doctrine they continue to pass on to this day, and it's something that, of course, any Freemason would immediately recognize. But no one has ever written about this before, so this is kind of in line with some of the things I've been doing in trying to catalog.
That seems like extremely valuable work to me, and I'm sure others as well. I am immediately reminded of the foundational documents of the Rosicrucian fraternity, the Fama,
yes.
In particular talking about Brother R.C. traveling to the East. And it also strikes me in my studies of what I consider Western traditions that a great number of, if not most everything we've got comes from further to the East, the Middle East, the Arab lands, and beyond.
Yeah, well, you know, we forget, you know, during the Dark Ages in Europe, there were initiates within Islam that were the only people who were translating Greek texts. They're the ones that were finding Greek texts, translating them, passing on knowledge from the, of course, the Greeks were passing on knowledge from some of the Egyptian mysteries. But while Europe was in the process of, fighting amongst itself, within the Arab world, alchemical doctrines and things of this nature were being translated and preserved. And, there are mystical societies that continue to exist, like the Druze and the Sufi. The Sufi is another group that, there are different Sufi orders out there, but, they've preserved these traditions, and they have, doctrines and rituals, that are identical with what we would recognize within the Western initiatic tradition.
Now,
could
you help us understand in a little bit greater detail, because sometimes it's easier if we start classifying things, and I'm curious, and some of these groups that many of us have no familiarity with whatsoever. You mentioned the Druze in particular. Are we talking primarily about initiatic tradition along the lines of a ritualistic thing as a la Freemasonry, or are we talking tantric practices that we would maybe think of as like inner alchemy, or maybe even more laboratory work? I don't know.
Yeah, kind of all of the above, actually.
Okay.
Different, they do have initiation ceremonies. There's different mystical groups and orders. Some of the Druze tend to be more Unitarian. They believe in reincarnation, and they have a very Gnostic tradition.
Now, do they self-identify as Christians?
No, they primarily work within the Islamic community.
Okay.
But the thing with the Druze is you can't be initiated into the Druze unless you're born a Druze, into a Druze family. So it's very, even though they're willing to share certain doctrines and that type of thing, they remain pretty secretive. And there have been accounts throughout history of Western people being initiated into some of these doctrines. And, frankly, I don't know if they really were, to be honest, just based on, what I know about the Druze. But it's possible they were certainly shared in shared traditions and would hold maybe roundtable discussions and that type of thing. But some traditions like the Sufi, the Sufi are purely Islamic. You have to be they're basically a mystical Islam. They interpret the Quran in a mystical, symbolical manner, and that it relates to the internal transformation. And they will, I've seen had the opportunity to witness some Sufi initiation ceremonies in Istanbul, for example, in which, a candidate is brought in with a, what in Freemasonry would be recognized as a cable toe or a rope around them. They go through a series of circumambulations around an altar. They take certain obligations or oaths, and they are then brought to light in a ceremony in which they are presented with certain vestments. People who were familiar, who have been initiated into streams of Martinism, would recognize some of the Sufi vestments as being identical to what's found in Martinism. And they, and then ultimately the dervishes in particular are, there's a fez that's put on their head, but this fez is, it's a tall type of fez that's supposed to be reminiscent of an Islamic tombstone, because the candidate is said to have symbolically been died to this world and then raised to the new light of gnosis or knowledge, and they're supposed to dedicate their life to that. So, you know, it's very much from a Western esoteric standpoint, those ceremonies are identical to things that we would recognize here.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then they pass on with that, they pass on their esoteric doctrines and their, which include both meditational techniques, internal, development, things. For example, the Sufi will do a series of chanting, and, these will be repetitions of sounds, and the ones they're most famous for are these sounds that go si, 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 sa, 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 so, 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 so. And the emphasis there is on the vowel sounds of the I, the A, and the O, which they represent as the expression of deity, manifesting, which anyone familiar with Gnostic, traditions and texts will recognize that those same, you know, letters are used in emphasizing deity within the Gnostic tradition, and Freemasons will recognize that those letters are also the only vowels that are found within the first 2-degree passwords within Freemasonry. So it's very interesting.
It's fascinating, actually. Now, I don't want to put you in the spot here, but you've done the research, so I think you're better suited to have an opinion on this question. You've identified similarities between ancient traditions and modern tradition of Freemasonry, Gnosticism in particular, and now you've drawn very solid connections, both philosophical and in ritual and symbolism, with other traditions throughout the world. And what I'm wondering is, in your own mind, do you believe that these traditions originate from a single source, or do you believe that they arrived at very similar philosophies and even rituals and symbols from different origins?
You know, that's a good question. Some things I think we can trace a initiatic lineage, if you will, back to a primordial tradition, if you will, possibly even back to Egypt. A lot of the traditions say they all came from Egypt originally. Western scholars have been, you know, quick to dismiss those claims, but when you start to see the same things popping up in all these different cultures, and they're all saying they came from Egypt, maybe, you know, there's some truth to that. I don't know. But, you know, there's some, we know that there were travels that occurred between to countries like, if you take the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, for example, you know, one of the people I had the good fortune of studying with was the Venerable K.C. Ayeng Rinpoche, who was very well known in the Tibetan Bon Buddhist tradition. And we know that a lot of these the practices and rituals that are done within Bon Buddhism are, you know, carry identical things as well. But we also know that there were Gnostic Manichaeans that had made their way up into China and parts of Tibet very early on, and they may have had an influence on the developing Buddhism that was happening there because the doctrines were so similar. However, there's other traditions. For example, I had the opportunity to also go and meet with some Mayan tribes down in the Yucatan and witness some of their ceremonies. And, you know, they have a ceremony where the candidate is brought in. Well, first they incense the sacred space, and they have four altars that are placed in the four cardinal directions, and they receive an elemental sacrifice at each of these altars. So there's earth, water, air, and fire. And then there's a central altar where the jaman, or the shaman, it works from, and it represents the quintessence. And this altar is composed of is based on a very specific geometry that's based around the square and the circle being united. And in the ceremony, all the officers of the Mayan tribe, they all wear aprons. The jaman, he has an all-seeing eye painted on his chest. And we found statues of jamans that have been pulled out of pyramids in the area that go back, some of them go back 1400 years. And they're depicted the same way with this all-seeing eye on their chest and wearing an apron. And in the ceremony, a candidate is brought in. They're made to circumambulate around the center altar and give sacrifices to the different, the four outer altars, after which they have to go through a obligation or an oath at the center altar. They then go through a symbolic death where they're symbolically killed, and the jaman then pulls they pull a fire out of his chest. It's like they're pulling a fire out of his chest, and they keep this fire in their palm, and it gets passed around to the other officers, and then it gets passed back to the jaman, who takes the fire and he has it in his hand, and he uses it to raise the candidate back to life with a special grip. And at that point, the candidate is given, or the new initiate is given a new a symbolic word that represents the word of creation. And then this candidate is invested with his own apron and his some other vestments. And it is, from anyone familiar with Western esoteric traditions would recognize identical elements. And the question remains then, well, how did these Mayan tribes, when did they adopt this practice? We know that there are texts and there are statues and there are things of this nature from the area that, again, show them doing these same rituals and using the same symbols going back 1,400 years, which was before, European contact, theoretically. And yet we're, so they've been practicing this, which suggests that either, there was more contact in the ancient world than people know, and that these traditions go back, they were cross-pollinating between cultures across the Atlantic, or there's some sort of collective group consciousness in which, everyone's picking up on and doing the same things, or, it's all a bunch of crazy coincidence, but, I find that one a little bit harder to believe,
Yeah, as do I. So. Now, you mentioned that you had been participating in some initiation ceremonies in the Great Pyramid in Egypt. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So Circe's International, is a outer body think tank, if you will, in which we bring in initiates from all different traditions in order to, work together and trying to help solve some of the world's problems, do research, do ambassadorial work and that type of thing. And generally try to help revitalize the esoteric communities as a whole, the different orders out there that are doing the great work. Within Circe's, we have a study program. It's about a 3-year study program at the end of which, people can be invited into, being knighted into the Order of the Temple. Or the OSTI, the Ordre Sauvage du Temple Initiatique. And we have done initiations in the Great Pyramid for hundreds of years, actually. But we don't get to do it too often, and this was my first time ever getting to experience in initiating people in the Great Pyramid, and I must say it is an incredible experience. I know there is, there's always all kinds of debate on what the pyramid, the Great Pyramid in particular, was built for, and with standard archaeologists saying it's a tomb. I don't happen to believe it was built as a tomb at all. I think it was built for a number of reasons, but one of the things I really truly believe it was built for was for initiatic work. And because the different stages and the different chambers in the pyramid are all conducive for a certain work that we know has traditionally been done within the initiatic traditions. And in this light, really the initiatic process, starts out down in the subterranean chamber. There's a pit down there that had been filled with water in times past, and it looks very much like a Jewish mikveh, or a ritual bath, or what would be used for a baptismal pool. And, the initiations would begin down there, and it would culminate in the king's chamber itself. And one of the things that you don't get a sense of when you are reading about traveling through the pyramid in a book, for example, because usually most books are concerned with the architecture, the history, and they don't really talk about the feelings of being in a place like this, or what the psychic impressions are like. And, there's a couple things that I will point out to the listeners, so if they ever get the opportunity to be in there, they can try it out for themselves. The first is that the when you're in the subterranean chamber, there are places where you can stand, you know, you're deep down in the earth, about 100 feet below the pyramid itself. And there are places where you can stand and have your feet on the ground, and you can connect your hands up to the ceiling. And when you do that, you can very definitely and very clearly feel waves of currents of energy going through your body from your feet, going up through your hands up into the ceiling. It's very, very distinct. You can feel it very clearly, and it's kind of draining, to be honest. But you can feel the energy going up, no doubt about it. So that's one thing. The other thing is, when you get into what's called the Grand Gallery of the pyramid, it is built in such a way that these people had to have been masters at acoustic sound, you know, and understanding it. Because when you get in there, the Grand Gallery actually cancels out sound. The Grand Gallery connects to both the Queen's Chamber and also the King's Chamber. And since the Grand Gallery cancels out sound, if anything was going on inside either one of those chambers and you were in the Grand Gallery, just outside of the chamber, you wouldn't be able to hear it. And that's a pretty fantastic thing in itself. But it's the sound is, if you yell or clap or anything like that in the Green Gallery, you're not going to hear anything. You know, it just doesn't echo at all. Whereas when you get into the chambers, like the Queen's Chamber, and in particular the King's Chamber, the acoustics in there are such that everything is magnified. And you almost have to speak quietly and slowly, because the sound just resonates all around the room, and it has this incredible reverberation. And, if you were in one of these chambers and you were trying to intone, some sort of a sacred sound, for example, or words to produce an effect in the consciousness of an initiate, I can think of no better place to do it. I mean, it is unbelievable. So those are just a few of the, a few of the things that, people ever get the opportunity to go into the Great Pyramid and go to these places to try these things out,
Yeah.
It really helps you to get a sense for, why this thing was built. And, the other thing that you have to remember is, the Great Pyramid, yes, it has massive stones. We really don't know how they did it. They built it. But whoever built this pyramid, it was easy for them to do it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone to the trouble of moving these massive, massive blocks. And that's something we need to keep in mind. Because it's not easy for us. It would not be easy for us to build it. And the only place I've seen larger stones in my life at a megalithic construction was at Baalbek in Lebanon, where there are stones that are anywhere between 1,200 and 2,000 tons, which we can't even move today. We have no way of moving those today, so we don't know how they moved those and put them in place. But interestingly, the platform at Baalbek is very similar to the platform in the Great Pyramid itself. They're both resting on these giant platforms that are made of these huge megalithic stones. And
Does the tradition itself, or have you formed any opinions based on your travels and research about any kind of technology or some sort of explanation for these constructions?
Well, you know, of course, the tradition, the esoteric tradition has always harkened back to the idea of Atlantis, you know, that there was an advanced civilization in antiquity. Of course, the Mesoamerican traditions all say that they originally came from a land called Atlan, and that was destroyed in a cataclysm. It's not too far of a stretch to connect Atlan with Atlantis. From what Plato talked about, but however, we don't know how a lot of these things were built. We don't have the technology, or we don't know how they did it, let's say. But however they did it, it had to have been easy for them to be able to do it, and it's not easy for us. So. You know, that raises complications.
Yeah, this is something I've wondered about most of my life, I think. So,
yeah.
I don't expect I'm going to get an answer, but I certainly don't stop looking, I guess.
Well, it's worth looking. You know, I mean, I think some people revel in their superiority and they don't, or the greatness of their civilization, and they don't stop to think about, you know, what's been before and why were monuments built, and why was that, why did civilizations decline to a point where, you know, those technologies weren't remembered? When, again, you're talking about things that we can't do today, you know. You know, along these lines, and based on the Atlantean idea, you know, one of the things I was cataloging while I was down in the Yucatan was there are pyramids down in the Yucatan area of Mexico that have would appear to be trident shapes on the tops of them. And so I include some of these in my book. And what's interesting about that is, you know, that symbol, that trident symbol, is something that you find around the world. It is associated with Shiva. It's associated with Poseidon and Neptune. And of course, Atlantis itself. You find it in the both North and South America. Some of the Mayans consider it a lightning rod, represents a lightning rod for their deity figure from times past. But it's also within the Templar tradition that I represent. You know, one of the symbols of the Grandmaster is this trident. And some people believe this is really the origin of the French fleur-de-lis symbol, which were associated with the Merovingians. Those people familiar with the Merovingian myth, you know, their origins and how, you know, they talk about this kind of breeding at their foundation with these beings that came from the sea, you know.
Yeah, and to my mind, that also harkens back to Atlantis and you know,
of course,
men who came out of the serpents or the boats or whatever you want to call it.
Yep. So, but this is a universal, another one of these universal symbols, and if you're thinking of creating a universal symbol, I mean, there are some symbols that you would expect, perhaps, like a square or a triangle or a circle or even a point within a circle, which you find all over the place. But a trident is not something that you would think of, oh, you know. Yeah. And yet we do, yet we see it all over the world, all over the ancient world.
Now, I want to make sure I get in this question before we run out of time, because the world is in some turmoil, I would say. And many people are feeling what I would call an apocalyptic type of energy, whether or not that's related to 2012, perhaps it is. Why did you feel it was important to make these journeys and to publish your book now?
Well, you're right. We have reached a critical stage, I think, in our development, in our spiritual evolution, our consciousness evolution. Our technology hasn't quite caught up with our spirituality. And we are at a point now where we have the ability to cause damage, not just to humanity, but to our planet, and in ways that, are apocalyptic in the traditional sense that most people think of it. But we also have the potential, with new technologies, things like the internet and everything else, we have the opportunity to reach out and come together more as a human race than we have in possibly ever before in history. And so right now is a critical time, that there are all these different esoteric traditions out there that are all working in what we call the great work, right? They're all working to spiritualize the material, materialize the spiritual, bring people to consciousness elevation, help to bring states of peace in the world, and help people to find peace within themselves so that they can be ambassadors for peace in the world. And all these traditions are passing on these things, but they don't necessarily all recognize the fact that they're all doing the same work as other traditions. My hope is that by bringing attention to some of these commonalities, the esoteric fraternities can start to have a renewed purpose in helping to guide humanity in the days to come, provide some of their light and their wisdom for the world. And we can work together in this regard. And I think if we don't, because when it comes down to it, if we don't do it, then who will? We're the ones that are through our initiations, through our studies, through our meditations, we're the ones that are charged with being leaders in the world. And we're the ones who are charged with trying to bring peace, build the temple of peace. And yet, how many people are? So, and if we don't do it, then who will? There's several years ago, I met with some of the Hopi tribes down in Arizona, Indian tribes, and one of the things they relayed to me was one of their myths. They said that, at one point in time, centuries ago, all the different people were all together. And at that time, they were given a secret handshake to recognize each other, and they were sent to the different directions of the earth. And shortly thereafter, they said there was a great shaking of the earth. And and they continued to live, essentially solitary for centuries until they saw the first conquistadors come across. And when they saw the conquistadors come across, they were so excited because they knew that one of the races of men was returning. And so they went out to give the secret handshake. And, you know, the conquistadors dropped a trinket in their hand. And they got really upset because they realized that one of the races of man had forgotten the secret handshake. Well, the secret handshake has never been forgotten. It's still being passed down by all these different traditions. And now is the time for us to unite, to try to build a better world, because if we don't, then, you know, we're in for some rocky times ahead, I would say.
Yeah, it certainly would appear to be that. Could you just remind people, if you don't mind, the name of your book and how people can get it?
Yeah, so the name of my book is called Entering the Chain of Union. Mm-hmm. And it will be available for order anywhere you can buy books. Usually the most sales come through Amazon. It's usually the easiest way, or Barnes & Noble. But it will be available in paperback format, and then also eventually it'll also be available in electronic format as well. So,
for bibliophiles, do you plan on publishing a hardcover version?
Yes. The challenge is that there will be a hardback version, but it's. There are a lot of colored pictures in this book, which is a first for me. If people are familiar with my other books, know I have pictures in them, but they tend to be black and white. And this book will be, have lots of colored pictures of things that have never been published before. And it'll be very exciting, but it also causes the price to be a little bit higher. So the hardback will probably be, a little more expensive, just because it does have colored plates in it. But I'm sure it'll be, for anyone of any esoteric tradition, Western tradition, I can guarantee that they'll get a lot out of it, because it's not a rehashing of, things that have been written in the past. It truly is firsthand account. It's eyewitness. Testimony of rituals that I got the opportunity to see, and conversations that I had with esoteric leaders, and there's lots of photos of all of this, so it's very, very exciting in that regard.
It is amazing. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Cannot wait for that. So, very much appreciated. Not just this book now, but your other books as well. I feel like you're doing a lot of groundbreaking work in this field. It's really appreciated. I'm sure you know it already, but I just want to say that.
Well, I appreciate your comments. I mean, I kind of feel like there have been so many great writers that have kind of provided pointed the way, if you will, of where to go. And all we have to do is go there. And if we go there, then there are magical things we can find that we can write about. And that's all I've endeavored to do. So it's really a joy for me.
Well, you make it sound easy, but I'm sure that it is anything but that. And we definitely, again, appreciate it very much. So thank you again, Timothy Hogan.
Yeah, thank you.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Timothy Hogan and I continue our conversation about the connections between esoteric traditions and more. Please join us.
I have come to a desert where love appears. Everything impure there has found total purity. What could coral be worth beside the price of the soul? See how a sun appears to an atom. There are thousands of locks, each vast as heaven. A few letters in the shape of a key open them all. My heart is like a vast tablet of light. An ocean of agony drowned it again and again, but it became a warrior after being martyred 100 times. I venerate each one of the waves of this ocean. I'm at once the feast and the disemboweled victim. I'm the slave of a fish that comes from the sea. Each drop of this sea clothes a form that appears. Each form carries the name of a saint or mystic. O my soul, enter and purify yourself in this boundless ocean where one drop engenders 1,000 graces and visions. The swells and storms of destiny imperil every ship, but in this sea of peace, all find safety at last. Satisfied with your lovers, may the death of lovers be holy. May your beauty be a feast for them. May their souls burn like incense in your fire. O beloved, you have spilled my blood with your own hand. May that same hand also bloody my soul. May anyone who says, "Save him from love," have his prayer chased from heaven. On the path of love, the moon dwindles and disappears. May this dwindling from love become a fullness. Others demand a respite from death, but lovers cry out, "No, let it come fast." Heaven is made of the smoke of hearts that burn away. Praises, praises to all those who are burnt away. Cupbearer, pour the wine. Let it flow and keep flowing. I am sick of swinging between hope and fear. Shatter thought. I want nothing to do with it. Tear from my heart all unstable imaginings. Hack from their chains the shameless joys of passion. Dance into our assembly, beloved. Unveil your face. Scatter graces with each swirl of your robe of flame. Look at these madmen, dancing out of themselves for you. See how they've stripped themselves of the rags of time. Even to detachment the heart can be attached, God knows, for the heart is a net spread for misery. Transform my heart to a placeless place of safety. Carry it into the mountains where it dies into you. Come quickly. My body's tired of this country. Make it drunk, set it free, call to it, come quickly. Offer me a cup overflowing with the wine of wonder, so I can no longer tell my head from my feet. Don't give me bread or water or peace or sleep. Thirst for you is blood money for 100 souls like mine. Today, my beloved, you have swept me to your table. Let me stammer and stagger at the glory of your feast. News has raced through the city. Today, today's the day of joy. You are an ass if you want anything but God. A sad and crazy ass trying to get fat on ash. Know that the grass of ash dirties the mouth that eats it. And remember always what the prophet said. Stay away from the green of filthy places. Beloved, I am far from the grass of the ash pits. I am far from the houris of the gardens. I am far from pride, far from vanity. I am drunk on the wine of the divine majesty. The thought of a final beauty leaps like a deer in my heart, like the moon racing up the sky, like a lily lifting its head suddenly from the river grass. See, all the world's images are running to your image, scraps of iron drawn by a magnet of light. Diamond becomes stone before you, lion small flowers, the sun before you shrinks tinier than any atom. In you this whole world blazes now, like Mount Sinai. Each of its atoms foams over with fire water. Each soul becomes Moses, lost in the vision of God. Each creature is soldered to you and its own origin, laughing at nothingness and clapping its own miracle. Each leaf opens fresh and bright. Each atom is singing its discovery. Acceptance is the key to happiness. Grace is the door to the peace beyond the mind. Define and narrow me. You starve yourself of yourself. Nail me down in a box of cold words. That box is your coffin. I do not know who I am. I am in astounded, lucid confusion. I am not a Christian. I am not a Jew. I am not a Zoroastrian. And I am not even a Muslim. I do not belong to the land or to any known or unknown sea. Nature cannot own or claim me, nor can heaven, nor can India, China, Bulgaria. My birthplace is placelessness. My sign, to have and give no sign. You say you see my mouth, ears, eyes, nose. They are not mine. I am the life of life. I am that cat, this stone, no one. I have thrown duality away like an old dish rag. I see and know all times and worlds as one, one, always one. So what do I have to do to get you to admit who is speaking? Admit it and change everything. This is your own voice echoing off the walls of God. This entire world is the form of universal reason, which is the father-mother of all lovers of the divine word. Be ungrateful towards the beloved, and nothing can change. Make your peace with your beloved. Abandon disobedience. And this world's water and clay will appear like a gold carpet, and resurrection become your immediate experience, and heaven and earth be transfigured in your eyes. Since I'm always at peace with my Father, the world always appears like a paradise to me. At each moment, a new form and new beauty appear, and their glory dissolves all fear and boredom. I see the world radiant and brimming with magnificence. The waters constantly flowing from the springs of heaven. The sound of these waters is always enchanting my ears, my deepest mind and consciousness, real with bliss. The branches of the trees dance for me like penitents. I see leaves everywhere, clapping their hands like musicians. The mirror's shining seeps through its velvet sheath. Imagine the blaze when the mirror itself appears. The second you stepped into this world of existence, a ladder was placed before you to help you escape it. First, you were mineral. Then, you transformed into a plant. Then, you became an animal. Then you changed yet again and became a human being, endowed with divine consciousness, reason, faith. Look at your body, made from dust. What perfection it has. And when you have gone beyond being human, you will, without any doubt, become an angel. You will be done with earth, and heaven will be your home. Go beyond even that angelic condition. Dive again into God's boundless ocean, so your drop of water at last transforms into the sea.